Okay, we're going to start in the book of 1 Samuel, chapter 28. The title of this particular section, David, is particularly, remember he's in the land of the Philistines, moved to Gath under the authority and reign of King Achish. But in chapter 28, we are seeing that Israel goes to war under the reign of King Saul. So, beginning in verse 1, we read a little bit about David. And it came to pass in those days that the Philistines gathered their armies together for warfare to fight with Israel. And Achish said unto David, Know thou assuredly that thou shalt go with me to battle, thou and thy men. And David said to Achish, Surely thou shalt know what thy servant can do. And Achish said to David, Therefore will I make thee keeper of mine head forever. The keeper of mine head, basically, David, you're going to be one of my personal bodyguards. I'm going to make sure that where I go, you go. You can watch out for me out in the battlefield, an armor bearer, you might say. Someone who ensures that I survive the wars that I'll be fighting. But this next war, David, is going to be against Israel, the people that you hate, the people that hate you, the people that you're looking for opportunities to destroy. And why would King Achish believe that David is looking to destroy the Israelites? Because David has deceived King Achish into thinking that's what he's been doing all along. As David is coming back with spoils, animals, and supplies, who is he convincing Achish that those supplies came from? The southern border of Judah, Israel. He's convinced Achish that he has already raided Israelite cities, killed their people, and taken their stuff. And now King Achish says, Hey, David, I got something really great for you. You don't have to just raid the small villages. Now we're going to war, and you could be part of a massive destructive force upon the nation of Israel. Now, David has to make a decision right there. He's in the court of King Achish. He can tell King Achish, actually, I have not been fighting the Israelites like I told you or made you believe. I've been fighting others. Or he can agree to fight. Now, David agrees to fight. We do not know what David actually believed. The Bible doesn't clarify for us. Do you think it's possible that David said, I've gotten myself into a position, there is no backing out, I have to fight now? Do you think David fully intended to fight, kill his own people in order to maintain a home as one of the cities in Philistine? What do you think? We got the mic. Let's walk around and find out. King Achish believes David's going to fight. David says, hey, wait a little while and you'll see what I'm capable of. What did David mean by that phrase? You can see what I can do. What did David plan to do? Any comments? So there's only two ways to look at it. David was either going to fight against Israel or for Israel. If David's on the battlefield and is going to fight for Israel against the people he's marching with, how long do you think David will last once he's on the battlefield? And the Israelites, who aren't too fond of David, are fighting him and the Philistines, while the Philistines, who find out David is fighting against them, is now amongst them. How long will David survive? Not long. So if David is deciding to fight against the Philistines, it is a death sentence upon him. But if he is deciding to fight against the Israelites, what are the chances that he will ever be their king? I don't think it's going to happen. And so David is put in a tough spot. I either have to kill my own people and never be their king, or fight for my people against their enemies and die on the battlefield because my people don't know I'm fighting for them. It's death or exile the rest of my life. Those are the choices David now has to make. How did David get to a place in his life where he must choose between death or exile? I mean, he's already exiled, but up to this point, he's hoping that his exile will only be for as long as Saul is alive. Once Saul dies, David can return to Israel. But if he goes to war against them, that option is closed to him. How did he get to this point? Jimmy?
He's lying, and he's digging this hole himself.
And what decisions did he make that dug him to this point in his life?
Well, for one, he sought refuge with God's enemies. Just the charade that he's playing with the king. All that's nonsense.
You can only play both sides for so long until one of the sides is going to make you choose. And there's a lot of Christians who think they're playing both sides. I'm going to church. I'm in the world during the week and in the church service during Sunday. And it's okay to play both sides because I'm making God happy and I'm making the world happy. But at some point, one of them is going to make you choose. Either God's going to convict you and say, look, this is it. Decide now or destruction's coming. Or the world would say, why do you keep going to church? What is wrong with you? Why do you hang out with those hypocrites? And they're going to make you decide. And you've gotten yourself there by trying to befriend both. And that's where David's at, trying to be friends to both. Now, David, only by God's miraculous intervention, is not forced into following through with the horrible decisions that he's made. Very few people have the blessing of miraculous intervention upon their bad decisions. Most of the time, you will end up paying for your choices. Most of the time, when you've played both sides and you're not willing to make a decision against either one, there will come a day where you will have to, and there will be consequences for that. Now, the consequences are a lot lighter when you choose God, but there are still consequences. You will lose the friends you've worked so hard to gain, because when you choose God over them, they'll walk away. You might even lose a business opportunity. When you've played both sides of the fence in your company, and the company finally forces you into doing something not only immoral but illegal, and you have to decide, am I a Christian or am I not? And you say, I am a Christian, I cannot do this. They're saying, all right, fine, find another job. This is not for you, and you'll lose a job. All the years you spent into playing both sides, you have to give up one thing, at least one side. So David is forced into a position, according to Scripture, he's told Achish, I will fight for you. Whether that would have happened or not, we will never know. Now going into verse 3, Samuel is dead. Samuel has been dead for some time. The Bible is just reminding us that Samuel is dead because of the interesting events that are about to take place. So Saul, about to go to war against the Philistines, verses 3 through 6, he's distressed. The Philistine army is massive. He recognizes that his power as a king has been diminishing. His armies have not been doing so well. I mean, come on. Him and his 3,000 best men can't even catch one guy in 600 reprobates. So he recognizes, I'm in trouble. The glory days that I have had in battle are coming to an end. At this point, Saul is an old man. He's not so much a warrior himself any longer. He doubts the loyalty of his own people. Remember when they were looking for David, he says to his top generals, why are you for David? Why not against me? So Saul is just all distressed and discouraged. So what does he do in his distress and discouragement? He does what I think most people would say you should do, and that is go to the Lord. So he goes to the Lord. He actually prays out to the Lord. He calls the priests and asks them to pray on his behalf. He brings in the Urim and Thummim and asks them to use this communication method to God, to no avail. God does not respond to Saul. Does God ignore Saul because he doesn't hear Saul? He's closed his ears to Saul? He's not aware Saul is petitioning him? No. It is the idea of a parent who purposefully is not responding to the child for one reason or another. There's times where as a parent, I'm talking with my wife, and my children are asking for something, calling out my name, and there's nothing, it's not an emergency, they're not dying, nothing has been cut off from their body, they're not starving, they've eaten recently, they just want my attention. But in our house, I've told my kids that you cannot interrupt adults, especially mommy and daddy, when we're talking just to make you happy. So I purposefully ignore them. Now, there will come a point sometimes where they will just keep calling out. And so I will look at them and say, I'm talking right now, you need to wait, and then I'll talk to my wife again. It doesn't mean I didn't hear them. It doesn't mean I don't intend to respond to them eventually. It just means for right now, there's a reason I'm not going to talk to them. Now, what is the reason God is not talking to Saul? It is not because he's talking to someone else. God is fully capable of holding multiple conversations at one time. So why is God purposefully ignoring Saul? Saul has been ignoring God for decades. Over 10 years, well over 10 years. Saul should not be shocked when God returns the favor. You know, a lot of people believe that God is just on pins and needles, waiting, begging for us to talk to him again. Now, it is true God loves us dearly. And it is true that because he loves us, he wants to have a conversation with us. But God is not stupid. And the conversation that God wants to have with you after 10 years of silence is not just verbal speaking to make you happy. What is it that God wants to hear from us if we have not been speaking to him for many years? It is, I'm sorry, God. Not, I need you, God. Now, does that mean that if we ignore God for decades, and then we say, God, I need you, that God would never respond? No. Actually, I see many cases, experiences I've had with people, myself included, where God has responded when the first prayer was, I need you. I'll tell you, with my personal experience, it was not just an I need you, it was I need you, coupled with crying, and I'm sorry, and I need you again. It was a rotation of 3 to 4 hours of crying out to God, I'm sorry, but I need you, both of them together. I'm sure there are times throughout history where people have not been repentant, just said, God, I need you, help me, and God has responded. But God is under no obligation to respond to an individual who has ignored God for a good part of their life. And people, once God ignores them, feel like, well, then I was right to ignore God at the beginning. He's just not a good God, not a loving God. No, it's just God's not a stupid God. God knows your heart. God knows your thoughts. God knows the future. And God's not going to be fooled by your efforts at, hey, God, I'm here again, when all you want is his help. And that's what's going on with Saul here. Saul is not repentant. Saul has no desire to fix the relationship between him and God. Saul just wants help. And God's not going to offer it. Why wouldn't God offer Saul help? Is it possible that this is God's will, that Saul is going to be finally judged for all the wrongs? Well, why doesn't God just respond to Saul and tell him, Saul, this is your destruction? God already has. Years earlier, God said, Saul, this is what you did, this is what I'm going to do, and did that multiple times. God doesn't need to repeat himself. Saul's hoping that something will change, where God has already made his decision. So, Saul, seeing that God is not going to answer him, feels like, all right, I only have one more option, and that is to find a witch. Now, I believe that in today's culture, there's a lot of people who call themselves witches or fortune tellers, and they're a bunch of frauds. They really don't know any demon personally by name or they commune with and get information from. But I do believe there are people that are fully capable of doing such things. I believe that especially as you go into certain parts of the world that are a lot darker spiritually, that demon possession is a lot more prevalent and common. I believe that it is fully possible for someone to commune with demons and have the ability to gain information that they should not otherwise know. This particular witch, was she a fraud or was she the real deal? All right, a couple things I want to mention. First of all, Saul, we're told in verses 7 and on, that Saul had already had a lot of those with familiar spirits. To be with familiar spirit either means you are possessed by a demon or communing with a demon, which I don't know is much of a difference between the two. But those who communed with demons or claimed to commune with demons were put to death under Saul's reign. Why? Because it was legal under the commandments God gave that that would take place, that anyone who was going to commune with spiritual darkness, with demons, should be put to death. So Saul does that. It's kind of interesting that Saul would follow that part of the law when so many other things he would not follow, but that must have been something he was okay with. But there is one particular woman, we're called the Witch of Endor, who does not get put to death. Why? Is it because she's just such a sneaky witch that no one ever knows? Or is it because she's such a fraud that no one cares? Now, I kind of lean towards she's a fraud and no one cares. I'll tell you why shortly. But that's an assumption. It's possible she truly does commune with demons. It's possible she's just very sneaky. It's possible she hid herself all along. But if that's true, then how is it when Saul says, where's the witch? I want to talk to her. That right away they said, I know one, the Witch of Endor. So is she like the worst kept secret in Israel? The only witch left? Everyone knows about it and no one does anything. How is that possible when all the others have been killed? I think there's only one logical explanation. She's just a fraud and everyone knows it. Then why would they suggest her to Saul? Because Saul's desperate and these guys have no other answer. Their king is probably in tears. The king is upset. And everyone knows when your king's upset, King Saul, do something, otherwise heads will roll. So let's at least give him the Witch of Endor. So Saul travels to Endor, which is where this witch is from and which is why she's called the Witch of Endor. We're told that he arrives disguised. So he's not wearing his kingly robes, took off his crown. His servants look like normal guys, dresses down, and arrives at the door of the Witch of Endor. And he says, hey, I need some help. I need to be told the future. I need to commune with someone who's dead. And the Witch of Endor says, hey, you know the law. If it's found out that anyone's a witch, they're killed. What makes you think I'm a witch? And verse 9. And the woman said unto him, behold, thou knowest what Saul hath done, how he hath cut off those that have familiar spirits and the wizards out of the land. Verse 10. And Saul sware to her by the Lord, saying, as the Lord liveth, there shall no punishment happen to thee for this thing. How can Saul promise to her nothing bad will happen to you? Well, as a king, he has every right to promise you won't be killed. She doesn't know he's the king. He's not telling her he's the king. So what good is this promise? Not much good. I think probably how it's intended and probably how she's taking it is, I won't tell anyone. Now, he probably could have just said, I won't tell anyone, but I think that's kind of the roundabout way. Hey, don't worry, nothing bad's going to happen. I won't tell anyone. It's an opportunity to make some money. Obviously, he's going to pay her. You know, that's what happened. These witches got paid. Even today, you know, someone really could tell fortunes and save someone's life. Yeah, let's make some money off of it and, you know, see if that works, right? But that's what happens. It's been happening for some time. So, swears nothing will happen. Verse 11, the woman said, whom shall I bring up under thee? And he says, who? Samuel. How interesting. The last time he and Samuel spoke that we're aware of, Samuel disowned him. And Saul did not make any attempt to speak to Samuel again while Samuel was alive. Now, he wants to talk to Samuel while he's dead. Isn't that the way? So many times, people that we should be talking to while they're alive, only to regret the missed conversations once they've passed. Conversations that should be had, conversations of repentance, some conversations of forgiveness, conversations of advice. Take those opportunities while you can now instead of regretting them when they're gone. So here's where it gets a little interesting. We're told that the witch of Endor sees Samuel and cries out in fear. She's scared. She's shocked. Now, this woman who normally communes with demons, this woman who normally brings up the dead, why is she crying out when Samuel arrives? Again, I'm going to go back to, I think she's a fraud. I think even she herself was shocked that this actually worked. Is it possible she'd seen dead before? Possible, sure. Is it possible she communes with demons? Possible, sure. I'm just not sure that this is, in my mind, a reaction of someone that normally does these kinds of things. So, I don't believe she expected this to happen. Saul does not actually see Samuel. She screams, she cries out. And we're told that Saul asks, hey, what did you see? And by the way, before he even does that, the woman actually says, why hast thou deceived me, for thou art Saul? Now, why would she assume right away that he's the king just because she saw a dead person that she claimed she could conjure up? Again, she's shocked that she could conjure this guy up. And she's thinking there's only one guy that such an amazing thing would happen for. It has to be the king. Or God just opened her eyes. God gave her understanding beyond her own ability. I guess there's a few reasons there. But she recognizes that he's the king. And verse 13, be not afraid. What did you see? What sawest thou? She said, I saw gods ascending out of the earth. Now, this woman's unsaved. She's not a believer, obviously, communing with demons or attempting to commune with demons, right? So in her mind, gods, it's just godlike creatures. You know, anyone that can come up from the dead is a godlike creature. So she's not saying that she saw God, because I don't think she did. She's just little lowercase g. I saw godlike creatures coming up out of the earth. He said unto her, what form is he of? She said, an old man cometh up, and he is covered with a mantle. All right. Saul says, yeah, that's Samuel. Which means Saul cannot see what she sees. Which, by the way, makes it very easy for her to be a fraud. If that was indeed how it works, she could just always claim, this is what I see, even though you can't see it, let me explain to you what's going on. And that's what she does. She sees it and explains to Saul what's going on. So Saul then says, she said, it perceived that was him, stooped to the ground, bows to his face. Verse 15, Samuel says to Saul, why hast thou disquieted me to bring me up? And Saul answered, I am sore distressed. Now this is where it gets a little interesting. Verse 15, Saul can't see Samuel, but it seems that Saul can hear Samuel. Otherwise, the only other option is, the Bible doesn't tell us, Samuel speaks, the witch hears, the witch tells Saul what she hears. That's a possibility, but the Bible just says Samuel speaks and Saul responds. So I'm going to go with, Saul can't see, but he can't hear. Why that is the case, I do not know. So Samuel and Saul are now having a conversation. And Saul says, I'm distressed. I don't know what to do. The Philistines are here. What should I do? Can I win? Will I be the victor? And Samuel responds. Verse 16, wherefore then dost thou ask of me, seeing the Lord has departed from thee and has become thine enemy? Hey, why are you talking to me, a man of God, when you're no longer the friend of God? Why come to the man of God when you're not even talking to God himself? And you know, this is a question that is still asked by many today, including myself. People come to me, and they ask for help from the church. You know what one of the first things I ask them? Do you go to church? No, I don't. Now, it's not that I never refuse help to these people, but you would be shocked. Most of the people that come to me and ask for help do not go to church. Now, I don't know if that means because the ones who go to church don't need help because God helps them. I don't know if it's because they go to someone else other than me. I'm not sure. But a lot of people come to me over the years. Most of them have not attended church anytime soon or ever. Why are they coming to the people of God when they don't even go to God himself? That's what Samuel's asking, and I think it's a valid question. So we as Christians have to determine, when should we help? I don't know that I'm obligated to help every single person that asks for it. I just go case by case depending on what their needs are and who they are and what's going on and what I can do. But Samuel says, hey, you've left God, God's left you. Verse 17, the Lord hath done to him as he spake by me, for the Lord hath rent the kingdom. Hey, I already told you this is going to happen. You're going to lose the kingdom. You're going to lose your life. This is the time. Verse 18, you didn't obey God. Verse 19, the Lord will deliver Israel with thee into the hand of the Philistines, and tomorrow shalt thou and thy sons be with me. What does that mean, with me? It means dead. You're going to die tomorrow, Saul. Not just you, but your sons are going to die with you. Now, let's tear this up a little bit. First of all, was this really Samuel? There are some who claim this was a demon who acted like Samuel, because why would God allow a witch, an unbelieving witch, or any person to bring up a dead person? I think that's a good question. I think it's a valid point. I do want to point out that this is a very unusual circumstance. The Old Testament as a whole is full of a lot of unusual circumstances, together and separately. And so I would never come up with a doctrine by the circumstances we see in the Old Testament, such as the doctrine of prayer in Gideon. God, I will do this thing if I put the wet cloth out and the ground is dry. That's not a doctrine we should come up because of the instance of Gideon. But I think the story really happened. God did answer the prayer that way. So is it possible that God allowed this thing to happen while not encouraging us to go to witches and ask that Samuel be brought up and talk to us? I think that's fully possible. Is it possible, though, that this is all just a ploy? The woman really is talking to a demon. The demon is acting like Samuel, has fooled both the woman and Saul. It is possible. How would the demon know what's going on with Saul? Well, a lot of people know what happened with Saul. A lot of people know the kingdom was rent. The only question I have about this demon, what he knows, is how does he know Saul's going to die tomorrow? That's the only thing. Everything else is common knowledge. Could this demon be making an assumption, guessing, an educated guess? Fully possible that this demon, if it is a demon, making an educated guess. But I think we're really stretching the story really far when we go down that road. To me, when we take the Bible literally, I'm just going to take this as the witch was a fraud. This was Samuel, a unique instance where God allowed this to happen to remind Saul, again, Saul, this is just the culmination of your own bad choices. Tomorrow, judgment falls. And there's not anything you can do to stop it. That's my thoughts. I'll open it up now to the floor to see what you guys think about this situation. All right, Maddie in the back.
I just figure the Lord uses who he wants to use. He used a donkey to talk.
Sure, use a donkey to talk. Great reminder.
And he used this witch to talk to Saul because he wasn't obedient to the Lord, so the Lord didn't want to talk to him, so he used this woman, I believe.
Hmm. Yeah, God is fully capable of using unbelievers to accomplish things. I remember a man telling me one time that he has no doubt God was giving him direction, and he was shocked to find out when this advice was given to him, it was from a guy who doesn't go to church and not even saved. But he knew without a doubt this is what God wanted him to do, and God was using an unbeliever to give him direction. So that does happen. Good point. Anyone else? All right, Carla, up in front.
I'm just wondering, it says that Saul knew that it was wrong to have these witches and
sure,
wizards.
Sure, had to put to death, yeah.
And I think there's other places where it talks about not trying to get into the dark world of the dead.
Yes.
And I'm just wondering if maybe the reason that God told them to get rid of these people was because it might be true that they really can talk with the dead.
I fully believe it is possible for people to communicate with demons. Demons can communicate with individuals if they open themselves up to that. So yes, I agree.
Because I know we really encourage Christians to stay away from Ouija boards,
yes,
and seances and all that,
yep,
stuff, because God is totally against it.
Yeah, when
it.
People talk about weird experiences, you know, sometimes you got to wonder, they make stuff up. But there are stories I'm sure are true, that people do see things and hear things, and it's not because they're high, although that can help, I'm sure. They really are in spiritual darkness, and they're seeing some really dark things.
Yeah. I just kind of think that it probably is true that Samuel really did come up and,
yeah,
just tell him, hey, you did this to God, and God's going to do this to you.
Yeah. All right. Anyone else? Jesse, in the back.
I think throughout the whole story, Saul hasn't really shown a respect for God. And like you have David who is writing these psalms, who's praying. I know at this point in David's life, he's like making really bad decisions. But Saul has seemed to revere Samuel more than he has God. And
great
so you
point.
See God not answering, but he allows Samuel to be brought up, I think, maybe because Saul would listen to him more.
That's a great point, Jesse. I would agree with that. Now that you say that, it clicks for me too. I agree. He does revere Samuel more than God. That's how I see it as well. Thank you for that. Anyone else? All right. Did you miss something? Samuel said, tomorrow, where will you be? Not just dead. With me. Where is Samuel? Not in hell. Paradise. So, could Samuel mean with me as in dead? He could mean that. But again, if we take the Bible literally, with me is different than with the rich man in hell, right? So, I would say that Saul again was saved. And I think I said that before. The fact that he was at one point indwelt by the Holy Spirit should already clarify that for us. But if we've forgotten or been confused, when God punishes, punishment on this earth does not carry into eternity for a believer. Saul was going to meet one of the worst punishments that could be had by an individual, his death and the death of his children. By the way, his children will die before him tomorrow. One of the worst things that could happen, I think, to any person is to have your children die right before you die. He's going to have that destruction upon his life. He brought it upon his life. But at that point, it's over. And he now joins Samuel in paradise for eternity. God truly is good to be able to leave his judgment on earth and allow forgiveness to be entered into eternity for those who accepted it. Even those, and by the way, all of us fall in that category, who don't deserve it. But even those who don't deserve it more than others who don't deserve it, right? Okay, let's move on now. Saul faces his destruction. I want to say this about Saul. He gets up, verse 20. Well, first of all, he falls on the ground. He's sore afraid, crying, no strength in him. He hadn't eaten all day, so he's kind of losing physical strength as well. But verse 22, now therefore, I pray thee, hearken thou also unto the voice of thine handmaid. This is the witch talking to him, saying, hey, let me feed you. Let me help you. Verse 23, he refuses. I will not eat. His servants, together with the woman, compelled him. Finally, he ate. He arises and sits up on the bed. The woman had a fat calf brought to him, flour is made, bread is made. Verse 25, she brought it before Saul, before his servants, they ate. Then they arose up and went away that night. Okay, so Saul's initial reaction is one of extreme depression. Doesn't want to eat, just wants to die. Why? Because tomorrow he's going to die. But eventually, he eats, and what does he do? He composes himself. And where does he go the next day? He goes to battle. Would you be tempted if you were told, tomorrow, in battle, you're going to die? You think, well, in that case, that's an easy one. I just won't go to battle, right? Would that temptation befall you? I think it would for most of us. I will say this about Saul. In the end, he died like a man. Throughout most of his life, he lived and acted like a spoiled child as a king. But he died well. Knowing his destruction was coming, he faced it head on, marched into death. Why? This is not really the Saul that we know. The Saul that we know always tries to change his fate. God says, the kingdom will not be yours. I'm going to change that. The kingdom will not be your son's. I'm going to change that. Why now, when God says, you're dead tomorrow, Saul says, I accept that? What do you think? I have a reason, but I'm curious what yours is. A man who's always trying to change the destiny that God has given, why would he accept it now? Jimmy?
Well, I was quickly looking for the verse, but there's a text that says something about the death of a... they seek the death of a righteous man. So, I mean, even the heathen, you know, they want to live their life in all their liberty, but when they die, they want to die a righteous man.
Die as a hero.
I wanted to find the verse, but most people don't get to choose that. I mean... a heathen normally is taken, you know, he dies by his sin. But, you know, I see here his last act is, okay, well, I want the death of a righteous man.
Interesting.
If I'm going to die.
I agree with you, and that's kind of the direction I'm going. Here's what I think. What did Saul love more than even his own son? Years ago, Saul was in battle, and Saul said, do not eat any food until we're done fighting. If you eat food, I kill you. Who ate food? Jonathan had some honey. At the end of the day, Saul discovered that someone had had food, and Saul said, I'm a man of my word. I will kill anyone, including my son. Come to find out, it was his son. And Saul says, I'm going to kill you, Jonathan. Why? Because he hates his son? Because he didn't include others in his meal? Jonathan didn't even know Saul made that oath. There's only one reason Saul was going to follow through with that, because Saul cared more about his personal honor in the eyes of others. You might call it his testimony, the respect that people had for him. He cared more about people's respect, his testimony and his honor, than he did the life of his own children. Not much has changed. I do have respect for Saul that he marched into death knowing what was coming, but I believe that was the only reason he went. He could not live with himself with the idea that people would think of him as a coward. He'd rather die than be thought of as a coward. It kind of takes away from the honor that one would receive by marching into death, but there it is. Saul did not ever want to be known as a coward. That's not really a righteous quality. It's not a godly quality. It's actually a quality that will get you in a lot of trouble when you care so much about what people think that you're willing to die for what people think. There are times where you should care what people think. There are times you should not care what people think. But to only always care what they think is not a good option. Saul only always cared what people thought, to the point where he's willing to die so that they'll think well of him. And as Pastor Jimmy stated, die like a hero. Die as a righteous man, so at least he'll go down with a good name. Yes, Jimmy.
I found the verse. It's where Balak and Balaam were having their little get together trying to curse Israel, and the prophet said, "Who can count the dust of Jacob and the number of the fourth part of Israel? Let me die the death of the righteous, and let my last end be like his." So again, living a wicked life, but at the end saying, "You know, I want to die like the righteous." Not really your choice, but you know, again, that's what I think.
Okay.
That's all I did there.
Great. Let's move on now to chapter 29. So David is now put in that position, remember, where he's between a rock and a hard place. He's been told that you're going to fight along with the Philistines against the Israelites, and he had to make a decision. He made his decision. He said he would fight. So verse number 1, King Achish trusts David and brings him into battle with him. They haven't actually gone to fight yet, but David and his men are literally hanging out next to King Achish. All the princes come along. By the way, the princes are under King Achish. King Achish is the head guy here. And David is the head guy's armor bearer, and David's men are honored soldiers. So King Achish is giving these guys a lot of respect. Could it be he was hoping to bring encouragement to his troops? Hey, we're going to win this battle. We got the warrior of Israel fighting against the Israelites on our side, guys. This is it. This is ours. King Achish did not see the political problem he was bringing about. And how often does that happen? We think something's going to go great. Oh, I'm going to make this decision. The students are going to love it. My kids are going to love it. My spouse is going to love it. The church is going to love it. And they don't love it. And you're like, how did they not love that? I envisioned how this was going to go. Everyone was going to be on board, and everyone's going to be really excited. How did it fall apart? Probably because you only saw it from your point of view, and you didn't take time to ask yourself, how are they going to see it? You only assume they'll see it as you see it. Now, I am fully guilty of that problem myself. There have been many times in the church, in my family, at school, in a class, on the sports team, where I've assumed everyone's going to see exactly what I see, and we're all going to love what's going to happen, only to find out not a lot of people saw how I saw. In fact, the minority might have seen it. A few others just trusted me even though they didn't see it, and a lot of them didn't trust me and didn't see what I saw. And that's the problem with King Achish here. So he's probably patting himself on the back. Man, this is going to be great. I'm going to be a better king because of this. The princes come along, and they say, what in the world? What are you doing with David? He's an Israelite. And what are you doing with David's men? They're all Israelites. You seriously think that we're going to go to battle with these guys watching our back? They're going to stab us in the back. They said, we are not going to go to war if these guys join us. And King Achish's plan fell apart. Now, is it possible that these princes were actually smarter than King Achish and David truly was going to stab him in the back? We talked about it. I think that's a possibility. We'll never know. But these guys at least saw the possibility when King Achish did not. What does that tell you? Just because you're in charge doesn't mean you know everything that's going on. Doesn't mean you're aware of all of the facts. And it's good, the Bible says, to have counselors, especially when you go to war. And I try to surround myself with counselors as a leader. And I would encourage you, whatever position of leadership you have, to surround yourself with counselors, because they will see things that you're just missing. So David's loyalty is questioned. His intent, what he's going to do on the battlefield, is in doubt. The Philistines say, we are not fighting with that guy. And King Achish says, all right, I get it. Fine. Verse 7, wherefore now return, King Achish tells David, and go in peace, that thou displease not the lords of the Philistines. Now, verse 6, you can read that on your own. But King Achish, as he's talking to David, brags on David. And he says, David, you know, you've only done good in my sight. I've never seen anything evil with you in the last time you've been with me. You're a great guy. I really love you, but my princes don't like you. You got to go home. Get out of here. You know, King Achish is quite the politically correct guy. Like, you know, before he gives bad news, such as, oh, you can't fight with us, bad news for a warrior. The good news is you're a great guy. I really like you. You just can't fight with me. So he's kind of the kind of king that, you know, seems like a better king than Saul, really, the way he handles his people. But he sends David off. Now, this is where I am a little confused. All right, you're David. One of two things. Either you're going to fight against the Israelites and you don't want to, or you're not going to fight against the Israelites. You're going to stab the Philistines in the back knowing you're going to die. When the king says, you can't fight, go home, what would be your immediate response? Thank you. I'm out of here. Have a great day. Hope you win. Right? Wink, wink. That is not David's response. David begs for a chance. He says, what have I done? Why would you not trust me? Why would your men not trust me? What's going on here? Why can't I fight? What in the world? David, why would you push the point? Why would you press the matter? There's only two reasons I can think. David knows that his answer will be refused, and he's taking another opportunity to put himself even in better with King Achish. He's just being really sneaky. It's kind of like, oh man, I got to take someone out to eat, but I don't want to. Oh, I'll do it anyways. Go out to him and say, hey, you want to go out to eat? Oh, I can't. I'm busy. Oh, you sure you don't want to go? I'd love to take you. No, I'm busy. I was going to take you to the steakhouse and everything, man. I'm so sorry. And okay, I'll go, oh no, I got to take you to the steakhouse now, right? And then they accept your request. Whereas I think David was playing a gamble. That's all I can see. I think that's the most logical. David was gambling knowing that King Achish was not going to let him go, and he's trying to look like he's really a great guy. The only other option I can see is David is stooped so far spiritually that he really does want to kill Israelites. That's hard for me to accept. It is a possibility, though. So what are your thoughts? What in the world is David thinking by his response to King Achish? Jimmy.
I might have been guilty of that in the past.
Which one?
The food?
Next time you ask me, I'm going to wait twice and say yes the third time, see how far you'll take it.
So it has backfired on me before. It's like, no, sure, you really, you know, I really want to, you know, do this thing, and they're like, yeah, okay. It's like, ah. So that's, you know, when I read across that, that's what I was thinking, because I was just reading ahead. But I never really thought about it, but I can't imagine, you know, as you know, the mistakes that David's made, I can't imagine that he would just all out war against his own people.
Yeah. Hard for me to believe as well. Anyone else? All right. Fortunately for David, he won that gamble. The king says, no, you can't stay. You got to get out of here. And he sends him back. Verse 10, wherefore now rise up early in the morning with thy master's servants. Who are the master's servants? These are the soldiers of David. Not only is David the man, his men are the men. He says, you and all your men can head out back home. Verse 11, so David and his men rose up early to depart in the morning. So we see verse 8, David defends his honor, and then David returns to Ziklag. Of course, Ziklag is in the country of the Philistines, and that is the city that was given to him by the king. Okay, now we're going to look at chapter 30, and Ziklag is attacked. Now, David's only been gone a few days, but in that short time, someone has already visited the village of Ziklag. And it's not David's friends, it's the Amalekites, the enemies of both the Philistines and the Israelites. They attack Ziklag. We're told, by the way, later on, they've attacked multiple villages. It's not that they hate David and they just want to take his city. Although I'm sure that's maybe part of the reason, because we're told they do burn Ziklag, where they don't mention that they burn other cities. They burn Ziklag. But Ziklag is one of many locations which they are going to attack. David and his men arrive, 600 men, and they find that the city is burned and everyone's gone. Now, the Bible clarifies for us that every single person was kidnapped, women and children, whatever elderly, decrepit men, they were taken as well. No one was killed, no one was murdered, just the possessions were stolen, people kidnapped, and buildings burnt. David and his men have been marching back and forth for 3 days. You don't eat well. You don't sleep well. You're really tired. They get home. They're probably thinking, I'm gonna take a dip in the river. My wife's probably gonna cook a great meal. Gonna play with the kids. I'm gonna rest for half a day. It's gonna be great. And as they get closer, there's smoke rising in the horizon. And as they begin to run towards the smoke, over the horizon, over the hill, there's the city burnt. They search through the pile of ashes, probably assuming I'm going to see my dead children, my dead wife burnt before my eyes. As they dig through the ashes, they don't find any bodies. So then they recognize, actually, a fate worse than death has come upon my family. They've been kidnapped by horrible, horrible people who would do unspeakable things. And so now they're just broken. They lie on the ground, and these grown men have nothing else to do but cry. And David's one of them. We're not told how long they cry. I would imagine hours, if it was me, would not be just minutes. Eventually, we're told they have no more strength to even cry. They're done. Tears are dried up. And so, their thoughts are, there's nothing else for me in life. My family's gone, and the thoughts of what would happen are torturous to me. And there's someone that has to pay. Who's going to pay? It's going to be David. And all these men start talking. And David, off on his own crying, recognizes everyone stopped crying. And now they're all talking. And as they talk, they're scowling at him. And they're pointing at him. And they're getting louder. Now remember, there are some men that love David very much. And maybe some of these men are saying, no, we're not going to kill him. And maybe actually David started hearing the conversations because it got so loud. David knew, my time on this earth seems to come to an end. And so what does he do? As Saul did before him, David turns to God. But there's a difference between David and Saul. The difference is, yes, David has turned from God for at least a year. But when David turns to God now, David is not turning to God and saying, God, help me. We're told in verse 6, he encourages himself in the Lord. That has the idea of renews his relationship with God. Now, there's only one way to renew a relationship with God once you turn from him. What way is that? It is repentance. I think it is very obvious that this text implies David got right with God. Repented. Asked for forgiveness. Once his relationship to God was restored, he then has a question for God, only after restoring his relationship. And that question is, God, what should I do? I've made a mess of things. I turned these people that you've given me away from you, away from their families in Israel. I've turned them to do horrible things to villages that hadn't done us wrong. I've led them astray now for over a year. I've gotten myself into this position. What do I do? You think David is beginning to recognize that God also got him out of trouble with the king of Achish? I think David is so broken spiritually, realizing that he does not deserve any mercy from God, but God has already given him mercy. And now he's saying, God, give me mercy again. How do I get my family back? Where do I go? Should I go after the Philistines? Will I overtake them? God says, go, you will. God responds to David when he did not respond to Saul. Not because of favoritism on God's part, but because the way in which these two men came to God in different routes. When you're going to go to God as David did. Encourage yourself in the Lord. Renew that relationship with God first before you start making any requests. So verses 9 through 16, David and his men get up and they pursue. Verse 10, David pursued. He and 400 men for 200 abode behind. The Bible doesn't clarify for us here, but 200 men were just so tired, they could not go any further. The other 400 men had their adrenaline pumping through. They were stronger, younger. We don't know, but they kept going, 400 and David. As they're going, following the obvious trail, stomped ground, brush pushed over, droppings left over from the horses that they were riding and the camels. As they follow this trail, which is very obvious at a zigzag, it begins to get fainter. But as they follow it, they come across a man. This man's an Egyptian. And they ask this Egyptian, who are you, where you come from? And the Egyptian says, I was a servant of one of the Amalekites. So obviously this Egyptian had been captured himself in a city long before and was enslaved by an Amalekite, not of his own free will. Now he's left for dead. Why? The Egyptian says, I became very ill 3 days ago, and it just got worse, and my master was tired of lugging me along, so he threw me off to the side to die. Now, this guy's still alive. So either the master mistook how sick he was, the Egyptian was faking it, or miraculously, God allowed the Egyptian to restore his health for only one reason. What reason is that? To give aid to David. Isn't that amazing how God already has an answer for you? Before David even repented, God already had the Egyptian get sick. Before David renewed his spirit with the Lord, God already had the Amalekite master throw the servant to the side. The Egyptian was on the side of the road waiting for David as part of God's plan before David even knew he needed the guy. Isn't God amazing? Now, God knows the future. God knows what's going to happen. God knows the repentance. God knows the renewed spirit. And God already has certain plans in motion to be ready for you when you get to the place he intended you to be on all along. So this Egyptian explains himself, and he says, I know where the Amalekites are going. David says, okay, will you take us there? The Egyptian says, I will, on two conditions. Don't kill me, and don't give me back to the Amalekites. Obviously, it was a horrible thing to serve the Amalekites. And David says, deal. Let's go. So the Egyptian doesn't give him direction. The Egyptian goes with him. Again, it implies the Egyptian's not as sick as maybe he was earlier. So the Egyptian gets up, goes with them. Remember, David's marching. They don't have horses. So that means the Egyptian's doing what? Walking. Possibly someone's carrying him on the back. I guess I could picture that as a possibility if this guy's weak and small. But I think more likely is this guy got better. God probably just healed him. The Egyptian's marching along, going with them, takes them to the camp of the Amalekites. And we're told that David, he arrives at the camp. And in verse 17, David smote them from twilight even unto the evening of the next day. Now, we're actually told in verse 16 that these guys were partying. They were back in their home territory. And they thought, oh, man, we're safe. No one's going to be here. All the Philistines are at war with the Israelites. All the armies are gone. We're almost home. We're on our side of the border. This is going to be good. Let's have a party. Let's drink all the wine that we have. Let's get drunk. So that's what they do. Have a party and get drunk. David arrives again at the perfect time. Who allowed it to be the perfect time? God, again, allowed it. Do you think that if they had arrived during the day, his men would have waited for a better time? These men, whose wives and children are in that camp, you think they're going to say, all right, we'll wait 6 more hours. No, you don't do that. Your wife and children in that camp, you go in right away. And God allowed David to arrive at the moment of darkness, perfect time to fight, at the moment when they're all drunk. God's in control again. We're told that they fight all that night, throughout the morning, afternoon, up to the evening the next day. Now, for the Jews, the evening was a lot earlier than our evening. It wasn't like 10 or 9 o'clock. You know, it was earlier, kind of like late afternoon, early evening. And they fight them for not 24 hours, but a good amount of time. Remember, these are guys who could barely even march to this point. So again, how do they have the strength to fight for up to over half a day? The answer for me is God. Again, God is behind the scenes all along doing so many great things that these guys just don't deserve. We're told that the entire Amalekite camp is killed, save 400. And the only reason they escape is they got on their camels and rode off. Everyone else killed. Now, David and his men were told restored everything. All the possessions they got back. All their family, they got back. No one was killed. But what else did they get? If you read this passage, and we didn't for sake of time, the Egyptians said the Amalekites had raided multiple cities, both in Judah and in the Philistine countryside and other places. So they had a lot of stuff, not just the stuff from Ziklag. David got it all. David became a very rich man after this particular fight. God blesses him again. Not because David made good choices, but because God's just a good God. And there are times when all we deserve is punishment and God chooses not to give us that. He goes above and beyond and actually gives us a blessing. So David and his men, they return back to the camp where the 200 were at. And we're told that as they return to the camp, verse 21, that the 400 who fought with David said, hey, they don't get any of the stuff we got. Give them their wives, give them their children, and then kick them out. They don't deserve to fight with us. If they weren't able to follow us into battle, we don't want them by our side. And remember, these are men who have been fighting and walking and running for the last 4 to 5 days. They're not thinking right. These guys are talking smack about their own friends, about their own brothers in arms, because they're very upset. Their emotions have been up and down for quite some time now. So they're just saying things they probably don't really mean and probably wouldn't really say in different conditions. David's keeping his head, though. And David, by the way, the Bible refers to these guys as men of Belial, men causing disruption, disunity. David keeps his head and says, no, that's not going to happen. whoever stays by the stuff to protect it for whatever reason, either because I commanded them to or because they had no choice, they deserve just as much of the spoils as those who fought. Now, for me, in the 21st century, it doesn't really seem fair. I can understand, all right, part of the spoil, 50%, 45%, but why an equal share? I can only think one reason. Because there are times where a captain says, you have to stay behind. No one's going to want to stay behind when they don't get an equal share of the glory or the spoils. But when you know that whether I fight or stay behind, I get equal shares, then you're more likely to follow your commander's instruction. That's the only reason I can think of for David as a commander to make such a law. Because otherwise, it seems like it would be fair to have the fighters get more and those who stay behind get less. So David repairs the broken relationship between his men, those who are too tired to fight, and those God had given extra strength to fight. But that was not the only relationship David repaired that time. David took his abundance of wealth and gave gifts to a variety of cities in Judah. And he said, here's a gift from David. And the Bible mentions and it lists some of those cities. This was a very smart move on David's side. What is David doing? Mending broken relationships between him and the Israelites. Not all of Israel, but at least Judah, his tribe, the people whom he loves and knows. Hey guys, it's been over a year, haven't seen you. Sorry about that. Meant to write, haven't, been really busy. Here's a lot of money. You know I care about you. See you soon. There it is. The people think, oh yeah, David, I do like that guy. Man, a bunch of sheep and some clothes. He'd make a great king. And we're going to find that that is going to usher David in to become king. 2 Samuel chapter 1. Any thoughts about Ziklag and the fight afterward? Okay, then let's quickly. Oh, Jim, you have a thought?
No, I was looking back, and the Amalekites, some of the cities that David was raiding during his time there.
Yes.
They were the Amalekite cities.
Yes, they were. But remember, he killed everyone, so they didn't necessarily know it was David. So that's why it's hard to say if they were doing it as a vendetta against David. I think Ziklag was just one of many cities. It's possible, but David, the Bible made it clear that they killed everyone, so no one could say who it was. All right, Israel defeated. This is going to be quick. I just want to be able to start off fresh, 2 Samuel, next time we start, and also to give Jimmy a chance. Probably I will not be here next Wednesday to kind of go over some of the Psalms that cover the things that have been taking place. So Israel's defeated, verse 1. The Philistines fought against Israel. Men of Israel fled. Verse 2, Saul's sons are killed. His sons, Jonathan, Abinadab, and Melchishua. That's three. Now Saul has one more son that does not get killed and becomes king later, but three of his sons are killed first. Then verses 3 and 4, the battle is going very hard against Saul, and Saul is shot with an arrow. Verse 4, Saul's shot. He knows he's not going to survive, and he does not want to be killed at the hand of a Philistine soldier. So he turns to his armor bearer, the guy who's supposed to protect him, and he says, take this sword and kill me. And the armor bearer says, I can't do it, Saul. You're the king. My job is to protect you. How can I kill you? And Saul says, fine, I'll do it myself. Want something done? Got to do it yourself. So he takes his sword and falls on his sword and kills himself. The armor bearer is so distressed, he also falls on the sword and kills himself. Yes, it is foolishness, is it not? The story of Romeo and Juliet comes to mind. If you've ever heard the story of Romeo and Juliet, did you know that when one supposedly died, didn't really die, it was a Juliet who faked her death. Romeo thought she was dead, killed himself. Romeo came back from her fake death, saw Romeo dead, killed herself. Yeah, to kill yourself over someone else's bad decision is making a bad decision a worse decision. And that's what this armor bearer is doing. He could have escaped. He could have ran away. He decided to take his life. Ended his life early because of Saul's bad decision. Don't make that mistake of destroying your life, whether ending it early or otherwise, because someone else already chose to destroy theirs. Move on. All right. Verse 6. So Saul died. He's dead now. Verse 7. The Bible tells us that the Philistines went all the way to the borders of Israel. Now, under Saul's reign, the Israelites had actually fought, attacked, and defeated cities outside of Israel and taken them as their own. Now, when all of the Israelite citizens in these cities outside Israel find out the Philistines just won the war, what do you think is going to happen? What are the Philistines going to do? They're going to take back those cities. And if they take them back and you're there, probably what's going to happen to you? You're going to die. So the smart thing to do is what? Run. So they run. So the Israelites who were in the cities outside of Israel, they all run away. The Philistines arrive and the cities are just abandoned. So the Philistines then take the cities back as their own. By the way, they will be taken back again later by guess who? David. But for a time, they're going to be under the Philistines. Now, verses 8 through 10, the Philistines, as they're searching through the camp, taking all the spoils, they come across the bodies of Saul and his three sons. They take those bodies, there's kids here, I won't get into detail, but they do horrible things to the bodies, and they display them across the country and hang them on the wall, the walls of the city. We're told that there are some valiant men from Jabesh-Gilead who said, you can't dishonor the bodies of our king and his sons like that. And at night, these men risked their own lives to sneak into, past the enemy line, into enemy territory, up to the enemy walled cities. They cut down the bodies. And then with these bodies, lugging these bodies, they sneak past enemy camps again, through enemy territory, back into safe territory, all in one night. Now that is courage right there. What in the world? Why would these men of Jabesh-Gilead do such an amazing thing for a king who really wasn't a great king? What honor did they owe Saul? And we'll end with that. And that is a question, and there is a reason. Do you know what it is? Okay, to give the king, and by the way, they do give him a proper burial, but that's not why. Why the men of Jabesh-Gilead? Why not some other men of another city? Lura. Nope, it had nothing. The Jabesh-Gilead, people from Jabesh-Gilead had nothing to do with why Saul died. Saul died because he went to war against the Philistines and God wanted him to. But there is a debt owed to Jabesh-Gilead. What debt did Jabesh-Gilead have to Saul? Let me tell you a quick story. At the beginning of Saul's reign, a lot of people didn't want Saul to become king. Remember, he was hiding by the stuff, and they said, what kind of guy would hide by the stuff? This is not a good king. And the men of Belial said, we're not going to follow him. We're told that Saul went back to his farm and started working on his farm again. He didn't have a palace. They didn't build a palace for him. People weren't really that excited. And then we're told that some enemies came to a city. And they surrounded that city, and they said, we're going to make you our servants. You have a choice. Become our servants, and we'll poke out your eyes, or just let us kill you. Which one do you want? And the men of the city said, hey, you guys seem like really fair people. Give us 3 days, I think it was three, to send a messenger back to our new King Saul and see if he'll help us. And the enemy said, sure, we'll give you some time. See if you can get some help. So they send a messenger, and they allow the messenger to leave the surrounded city, and he goes to King Saul. King Saul says, yes, we will go help these men and women in the city. He's a new king, has no army. He has no palace. He takes an animal, cuts it up into pieces, sends it off to all the tribes and says, this is what your animals will look like when I'm done with you if you don't send people to come fight with me against our enemies attacking this city. He gathers an army together. The first army he ever gathered as a king marches on this city and defeats the enemies and frees the city. Guess what city that was? Jabesh-Gilead. 40 years earlier, this city still remembers what Saul had done for them. Yes, he was a horrible king, made some really bad decisions, but these guys looked at Saul differently because the very first act as king was saving their city. They repaid that debt, as all honorable men will do, by giving this king and his sons a proper burial. Let's close in prayer. Dear Father, I thank you for the time together. I pray that we would be encouraged and challenged through what we saw tonight, and we would strive to, like David, when we've strayed, come back to you, encourage ourselves in you, renew that relationship with you, that you may give us the direction we seek. In Jesus' name, amen. Have a great night, folks. You are dismissed.